I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is The Two Matts for the week ending Friday the 26th of April, the podcast that celebrates St. George's Day in the traditional manner. Didn't we, Matt? Did we?
Not really, but it's nice.
Is it traditional to interview two authors?
I think it is. And what authors? So we had our friend Tom Baldwin, who we had the other day to talk about his Starmer biography. He's written another book. Tom is a very distinguished journalist, and he was director of comms for the Labour Party and just written this book on Keir Starmer. And his friend and colleague Mark Steers has co-authored this book on England. And Mark is he's now the director of the UCL Policy Lab. He was a professor at Oxford before, and he was also chief speechwriter to the Labour Party. So they're a high-powered pair. And they've written this book about England and what it means. And they've been travelling around, and we had an absolutely fascinating chat with
them. We did. It's called England: Seven Myths That Changed a Country and How to Set Them Straight. And
It's out this week.
And I think listeners will find the chat really, really fascinating,
Interesting and original take on the subject,
and also how it may impact a Labour government in the future.
Yeah, it's very topical and very contemporary, so we recommend it, and we enjoy talking to them.
Yeah, so tune in now for our discussion about what England and Englishness means. This is The Two Matts, episode 42. Enjoy. So, Mark, Tom, welcome to The Two Matts.
Welcome to The Two Matts. Congratulations on the book. We're recording this on Thursday, which I believe is publication date. Hearty congratulations. It's a fascinating book, and I really do commend it to listeners of the podcast. And I want to ask sort of a few basic preliminary questions. One is that you, in addressing the issue of England, you structure it around seven cities and seven myths, which struck me as a very imaginative way of doing it. But I wondered how you got to that approach, how you adopted that strategy.
I think almost accidentally initially. Mark was in Australia. Mark had managed to move from South Wales to New South Wales, as we say. I was walking around, I was trying to sort of work out how we're going to do this book. And it was during lockdown. I went for a walk to Runnymede, where Magna Carta was sealed in 1215. It was so striking because all these new monuments had sprouted up since 2015, since certain aspects of politics had decided to make Magna Carta a huge thing again. And you realise the places and the monumental architecture around them almost embody the myths and show how the myths are the varying relevance of the myths at different times. And so, then I went to Plymouth and saw this vast amount of architecture and place, street names and different monuments and different statues for Drake. And you see how these different places are so tied up with the myths, but also that the people living within them aren't necessarily living the myth. They're living their lives. And that contrast between the ordinary life and this grandiose, engorged myth really struck me. So we then sort of tried to sort of fit these different myths to different places, and we came up with the structure.
And Mark, one of the interesting things about the book as well is that most sort of attempts to characterise a place or an idea nowadays aim at it's like a stock, reducing a stock to a simplification process. But you both seem to almost set out to look for nuance and ambiguity and to deflate the simplistic myth. So again, was that a conscious choice or did it come as you were?
Sort of, as Tom said, we started writing the book in a really weird way, which is, you know, it was locked down. I was in Australia, Tom was here. And so what we started to do is we had sort of Zoom calls with people all over the country, you know, sort of famous people and not famous people, older and younger, you know, richer and poorer, and tried to get a picture of what folks thought about England at the moment. And in those initial Zooms, it was extraordinary because this theme of sort of mix and muddle and complexity and nuance just like came through all of the conversations, even with conversations with people like Michael Gove, who you might not associate that with, you know, whose public persona might be sort of very either, you know, angry or grandiose or, you know, sort of big and booming. You actually get people to reflect on what England is. They very quickly go to, yeah, to the mix and muddle. And that kind of, you know, Tom and I just reflected on that right from the start then, which is, okay, if we're going to try and give a picture of the country, it's going to have to start from that nuanced, you know, much more complex place.
Well, let's take one of the places. I mean, you mentioned it, Tom, Runnymede, and especially for a lot of conservatives who, you know, fancy themselves as libertarians, it's a great sort of symbol of Magna Carta and libertarianism and this rather imagined narrative that says that the 1215 document signed by King John was the origin of basically when the day that liberty was invented. Talk us through how that's not true and the consequences of it not being true.
I think most people would accept the story of Magna Carta as a flawed one. You know, if you ask people what Magna Carta meant, I think the answer has varied significantly over the last 800 years, from sort of getting concessions to catch fish on the Thames and prevent Jews getting any, you know, I can't remember quite what the clause is against Jews, but it's certainly nothing about liberty, to symbolising the Civil War, a kind of restoration of a sort of basic English set of rights, which were never in the document, to then the Chartists picked it up in the 19th century as ordinary people's rights against the establishment and the power, again, nothing to do with the document. And then, you know, it was cited by suffragettes. It became a symbol in the Second World War. And but then you have this sort of period after the Second World War where, you know, Tony Hancock famously says, you know, Magna Carta, did she die in vain?
Yeah, yeah.
There's a sense of, you know, it people realising that it's a complete myth, seeing through it all. And then, of course, we get the Eurosceptics in the noughties. So Dan Hannan writes this book, How We Invented Liberty.
Yeah.
And he talks about Runnymede as a place of a global seismic event happened.
It was sort of the Manhattan Project of freedom, wasn't it?
Yeah. And yeah, the reason why they wanted to do that is because they had this conception of exceptionalism, of a sort of Anglo-Saxon birthright of liberty, that we'd invented, that we need to take no lessons from foreigners. Indeed, the European Court and the Human Rights Act is a threat to this kind of liberty. And David Cameron, who really should have known better, was playing into this. I think we describe in a book, he's sort of fumbling around a Eurosceptic erogenous zones with a speech on the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta, with Spitfires flying overhead and the That's Queen right. in front of him, you know, every single symbol of Englishness you could have. And he's saying that Human Rights Act is a threat because he's playing games with that. And it's the politicisation of these myths. I don't really mind a story about Magna Carta. It's a great story. I like the cartoon version with King John and, you know, the hissing snake. You know, it's great. It's when these things become inflated that they get in the way.
Yeah.
And distorted so that it's not relevant to the future of liberty in this country to think that we invented it. It's actually, you know, I think the kind of conception of freedom we found in Runnymede is a much better one.
Yeah.
It's about going for a walk on a drizzly Sunday afternoon and worrying about whether you should buy a scone at the National Trust Cafe. Yeah. It's so boring that you can take liberty for granted.
That's liberty.
That's our English expression of
it.
And I think that to be able to take it for granted is to be very free indeed, rather than being obsessing about who invented it and trying to sever all our links with continental Europe.
Did you discover on your travels around the country then, did you discover anything that was defining
England and Englishness? What did you conclude?
The best that we came up with is this idea of sort of mix, muddle and everydayness. I mean, the Runnymede story is really brilliant because Tom, when he went, you know, and I was in Australia and he went wandering off during lockdown to have a look around Runnymede, you know, he bumps into people looking at the monuments and they've got this sort of, what I think is an extraordinary English response to them. They kind of think they're a bit ridiculous, a bit absurd. They know it's all kind of made up. But, you know, it's as Tom says, it's nice to have a little Sunday stroll. They enjoy the sort of quiet. They enjoy the countryside. And they are quite happy to kind of rub up against each other. And, you know, that's what we kept on coming across, is that actually the vast majority of English people, when they think about the country, you know, don't like bombast or, you know, puffed upness or claims of exclusivity or being the best in the world. They're almost at the opposite end. They're kind of, you know, a little bit melancholic, just getting on with it and sort of enjoying it for what it is, you know. Yeah. And we did some polling with the polling company More in Common recently, just when the book came out, to check in whether that's actually what people feel. And it's remarkable. It's like, you know, the vast majority of people, they don't want to turn their backs on the past. They're not interested in fighting a kind of culture war, but neither do they think that the past symbolizes, you know, sort of a moral mission which is greater than any other country in the world. It's just not who we are.
Yeah, and I'm interested to know, was the feeling of Englishness represented equally or not equally throughout the places you visited? Do we feel more English in certain places than others?
I think some people, in terms of what Englishness has come to mean, yes. Because I think during Brexit and the years after, there was lots of polling evidence, and Rob Ford does this very well in his book Brexit Land, showing that people who identified as English were more likely to vote for Brexit, were more likely to be concerned about immigration. What we're trying to do is not sort of reclaim one version of Englishness, but say there isn't one version, and that's sort of the point.
Right.
You know, it is in that muddle, in that, you know, the fact that, you know, everyone in this room has probably got a slightly different sense of Englishness, mm-hmm. that is actually very English. And rather than just recognise the muddle, we think we should embrace it, because in that muddle is a genius. That's where we become most creative. That's where the most brilliant things happen in this country, rather than trying to impose one-size-fits-all grandiose versions of this country, which were never true in the first place and have got no guide to where we go in the future.
Right.
I thought one of the most interesting sort of takedowns of the myths was in the chapter on Blackpool, because the idea of the sort of homogenous white working class has been such an important kind of dynamic in recent politics, and you really deconstruct. Can you tell us why it's wrong?
Well, I think the idea of there being a white working class vote is as wrong as there being a Muslim vote or a black vote.
Yeah.
Right? There are white working class people and they're all different. I mean, you know, who'd have thought it, right?
Yeah.
And
now you put it like that.
And the trouble with the debate is, you know, you have all these focus groups and polls and, oh, Labour are losing support of the white working class and they're all voting for Boris Johnson. And if you really look at a polling, the real party of the white working class is no party. They don't vote. They've turned their backs on politics. But that's not all of them, of course. And this is kind of caricature. So we went to the end of the peer shows, and there's these appalling comics. Yeah, who might, you know, me as a North London liberal was outraged about. And yeah, they were saying, you know, I'm not going to repeat some of the things they're saying, but it was, yeah, in fact, there was a couple having sex in the theatre, two rows in front of me, which I've never seen before in a theatre. Yeah, until security arrived, anyway. And the danger is we use that caricature of the white working class, saying this is what they are. Mm-hmm. And we've got to listen to them because they've become really important in politics. And we end up with policy made by Roy Chubby Brown.
Yes.
Yeah.
But that's not who they are. It's not who, you know, it's how, you know, they're going along for to be shocked, most of the audience. There's lots of decency and love and tenderness on display in Blackpool. Lots of care. That's as much of who the white working class are as Roy Chubby Brown.
Yeah.
And I was outraged by what Roy Chubby Brown said, rightly. I think lots of the people in the audience went to be shocked. What we don't do is take that outrage, say, oh, that's who they are, and empower a kind of caricature parody of the white working class, but, and elevate it up into a form of politics.
Isn't it also true, though, that Roy Chubby Brown is part of
of Englishness. I mean, I can remember since I was a school kid, Roy Chubby Brown being jokes being told and being for that shock purpose. You know, even then they were, you know, beyond the pale. And that was the whole point of him. But there's something, there is some, you know, we can't just push all that to one side and say, well, that's exceptional. It's not. It's part of
English. No, that's right. But it's, I think the key is that it's a part, and what politics has done is it sort of concentrated it down. So, you know, so you're absolutely right that, you know, there are elements of these myths which you see in everyday life, you know, like the Roy Chubby Brown one, and they are real and they have been around for a very long time, but they've been turned into the sort of essence of Englishness by these myth-making politicians who want to say it's that and it's that alone and that's the real thing, that's the authentic thing, and everything else is just rubbish. So, you know, white working class voters who vote for the Labour Party or don't vote for anybody who are or are completely turned off by GB News or by Reform are suddenly described as not white working class anymore, you know, it's just like the stereotype, this kind of form of identity politics that we've generated. And I think that's what we see in all of the myths, is that elements of truth, elements of, you know, fun, elements that we wouldn't want to get rid of because they are, you know, enjoyable stories to tell. But the problem is when you distill them down, concentrate them and say that's the essence of Englishness and nothing else counts.
Did you encounter any parts of the world, like, I mean, I'll prefix this by describing Liverpool,
right?
Because I grew up in Liverpool in the 70s and 80s, where there was a disassociation from England, almost literally driven by the Thatcher government, who was saying, let's run the place down. You know, Geoffrey Howe wrote a memo to Thatcher saying, let's just manage decline. So growing up in Liverpool, the last thing you felt was English. You know, you felt European, you felt Scouse, definitely. But, you know, you were encouraged by the government, by Westminster, to feel alienated from England. And I wonder, has that healed completely, or, you know, is it?
I mean, I think
we
almost see the opposite now, which is that I think of all the places we visited in the book where that sort of distance from England and Englishness is strongest is probably London. So you talk to young people in London and you say, how do you identify? And most of them start by saying they're a Londoner. And then if you say, OK, well, what about the country? Then most of them go straight to Britain. And then they might go to Europe and they might go to the world. And sort of England doesn't feature in their self-description very much because they've come to see Englishness as wrapped up in these nostalgic myths or myths of the white working class or sort of Europe. Skeptic myths of liberty, etc., and they think, oh, kind of Englishness isn't for me anymore. But really interestingly, we gave a talk on the book a couple of days ago, and at the end, you know, a guy in his early 20s came up and said, I've never thought of Englishness or England before, but now I'm hearing all these stories, I recognize it is part of my identity. I just haven't wanted to acknowledge it as such because the only version available in public life or in political life doesn't appeal to me. But this, you know, subtler, more quieter, more complex picture, that's actually a true representation of who I am, and I'm kind of happy to be able to say that for now.
Right. So you go to Wolverhampton, which was the site of Enoch Powell's, you know, famous, notorious Rivers of Blood speech in 68.
He actually gave it in Birmingham.
Oh, he's in Birmingham,
he
wasn't he?
He represented Wolverhampton.
But he would be representable, my mistake. I mean, he himself, as you say, incarnated a certain kind of view of Englishness, a certain kind of racialized view of Englishness, which in a funny way, at the time, it created a crash barrier because it was, you know, Heath sacks him, and that's the limit you cannot go beyond. And then suddenly, the beliefs he represented in a bowdlerized form reemerge in the social media age in the hands of Farage and others, and we are, to a certain extent, living with the consequences. I mean, I wouldn't want to go too far, but, you know, a lot of powerlism is a lot of what we encounters day-to-day politics. Now, what was the upside of the Wolverhampton experience that sort of takes that down, that myth, the myth of powerlism?
I think that's important because every chapter tries to, after deflating this myth, find some sort of essence of hope, measure of hope, in the ordinariness of the place. And so one of the things that really struck me is I went with Pat McFadden, who's now a very important member of the Shadow Cabinet, to go to a Sikh temple in his constituency, and he warned me on the way. He says, oh, you know, they're gonna have a go at me about car park. I went, really? And he went, yeah, that's all they ever talked to me about, the car park. They really was about the car park. I thought, well, this is quite interesting, you know, because this is the city of Powell, and we've got Farage roving around the country, and we've got all this, and they're not talking about race relations, they're not talking about, you know, violence on the streets. they were about a car park, and there's a church, huge Church of England church, which no one goes to. It's got a big car park that's now an antique centre, and they can't have that. So the Sikh temple wanted to get this little patch of park, but the council says they can't have that. And it's been going on for ages. And in the arcanity of a planning dispute about car parking, I think there's something really hopeful.
Healthy society negotiating a problem.
Well, there's no rivers of blood in that car park.
Rivers of car parks.
Yeah. And it is, you know, there's something so English in its ordinariness that I actually left feeling really optimistic, even though I'd had to listen to Pat McVan having to push back for an hour about, I'm not going to promise you things I can't promise. But I've also, Pat's interesting in that, you know, he's Scottish. He grew up in Glasgow. His parents were Irish, and they spoke Irish at home. Is that, you know, he represents a seat adjacent to Enoch Powell's in England now.
Yeah,
he's a pro-European. I think that sort of that multi-layered identity is really important to cities. And you know, there's another great story from Wolverhampton, in that football, which has always been something which exaggerates differences. I mean, why Wolves fans hate West Brom fans when they're both from a black country and look and sound exactly the same? I've never understood.
That's why.
And for a long time, football was a vehicle for the worst sort of racism.
Yeah.
You know, when Barnes scored at the Maracanã in Brazil, the National Front fans singing, "We only won 1-0 because players, goals by black players didn't count, right? And now football has managed to transform itself. Not totally, there's still problems. But you know, the work that the Wolverhampton Wanderers community program does is extraordinary, reaching out to different groups. It's now got this group of fans with the Punjabi Wolves, who bring their dull drums to away games, and they've got their own sections, and they're part of the Wolves club now, and you know, recognised, and people are proud of them.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, it's not about street theatre bringing people together. It's through recognisable, ordinary things which the whole city sees as being part of Wolverhampton, and everyone else is now part of it too. That's optimistic.
Mm. I mean, that's so crucial, I think, in the Wolverhampton story, is that it wasn't that the sort of absurdity of Powell's sort of racism and attempts at sort of English purity was replaced by a kind of utopian idyll of, you know, multicultural diversity where everybody did street theatre and sort of, you know, waved rainbow flags or what have you. It's that you have this negotiation through everyday institutions which enables people to learn to live with each other. And sometimes they really like each other because they support the same football team. Sometimes they're having an argument about where the car parks are. But the sort of mess and the mix and the muddle is the realistic way that a diverse community lives together, keeps on going, and that's what England is, and we ought to, you know, not just sort of embrace it but celebrate it for that.
Did you get a sense anywhere that sense of community, that street by street community, has eroded at all?
I think that's what we thought we would find, but I think we found more resilience than we imagined. You know, so we go to Greenwich, to the Millennium Dome, or the O2 as it is now in a bit of the book, and I think we thought that we would find a sort of soulless part of London which was all sort of shiny apartment buildings with no one living in them because they're all owned by Russian oligarchs, and you know, sort of the old have been stripped out and replaced with sort of, you know, shopping malls and commerciality, etc. And there is some truth in that, you know, but Tom was hanging out there chatting to people. You also see the emergence of a new kind of community life. So there are new community centres, there are teenagers hanging out, chatting to each other, making friends, you know, going out with each other, planning the future as they always have. And it's almost like when you look at the dome now, it's not a shiny white surface anymore. It's got little bits of lichen and moss. And that's what's happened to the neighbourhood as well, is that sort of human relationships have started to grow again. And
there's a brownie pack there now.
Yeah, yeah.
And the shadow of the Millennium.
Yeah, it was fascinating that. I mean,
is
I found
really? Yeah. That's
yeah.
amazing.
Yeah. I found that chapter particularly interesting because it was the first sort of interrogation I've read of the kind of myth of modernity. In the 90s, you know, and we all lived through that, you know, in the New Britain, and it was exciting, and I thought, yeah, there's a point here, which is that you can't actually simply rest a governmental mission or a social order on a kind of everything must be new. It doesn't work, but it's very it is and was very intoxicating, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Matt was talking about Liverpool, and you know, Michael Hesstein went up Liverpool. he didn't want Liverpool to be evacuated, but he did sort of want to raise large parts of it to the ground and build anew the whole Albert, and Hester Thomas, of course, involved in the Dome. He was the first instigator of it before Tony Blair picked it up. And I think there's something, there was a big connection, I think, between Thatcher and Blair in this sort of modernity. I mean, Thatcher, of course, pretended that she represented Victorian values. I think we describe in a book as like sort of lavender-scented grandmother offering us cake.
Laced with amphetamine. That's it, yeah.
You got it. And you're right, it was exciting, but essentially it was vacuous and there was a reaction to it. So I think there is a direct link between that ultra-modernity of the year 2000 and then the reaction when you had the sort of countryside alliance on the march, the sense of something being lost. And I think you compare the opening of the Dome to the Olympic ceremony 2012. The Dome was, can we anyone remember what was in the Dome? I mean, it was all amorphous and sexless and weird and didn't really feel there's some plastic pubic life. What's that got to do with England?
Very weird.
Whereas the Olympic ceremony was an extraordinary muddle. It was like a sort of soup of different sorts of Englishness. You had the dancing nurses and you had Morris dancers and you had the Windrush and
Mary Poppins, Voldemort.
And in that sort of dreamy sequence, people actually loved it.
Yeah.
And that was a moment when almost we captured a sense of the muddle of this country and liked ourselves for it.
Yeah.
And I think, the tragedy of that is I don't think we then moved on and try and build something more out of it.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of the day Roger first published his famous thesaurus.
Then on Tuesday, we say happy birthday, Mr. Potato Head.
On Wednesday, the extraordinary stories of the child soldiers who fought in the American Civil War.
On Thursday, how King James changed the word of God.
And on Friday, what did spam emails look like in 1978?
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast, The Two Mats, is sponsored as ever by the New European Newspaper. And we've got a very special subscription offer for you, a new one, where you can get a free Bollocks to Brexit passport cover. That's right, you heard that right, folks. It's a absolutely top quality burgundy, like vegan leather, beautifully designed passport cover.
Pleather.
To have pleather, that's what they call it, isn't it? Pleather. To hide your new British blue.
The shame of the blue passport.
And you can get your free Bollocks to Brexit passport cover free with, and it's worth £25, by the way, free with a subscription to the New European from just £1 a week. And for £1 a week, you get all of our digital content, including the new app, which we've just spent an absolute fortune redesigning and is really, really superb now. And
the least you can do is subscribe.
The least you can do is help us pay for that. Or for an extra pound a week, if you like getting the newspaper delivered to your door, which I do very much.
Me too.
Every week we will send you first class post, our award-winning newspaper, The New European, and that will be a saving of more than 75% on the retail price. So to take this fantastic offer, and trust me, if you like this podcast, you will absolutely love The New European, go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2mats. That's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S, and there's a link in the show notes.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too. like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
How much is inequality part of Englishness? How much, you know, vestige of the class system that, we all grew up with and we now like to think has kind of eroded away, but how much of that is still kind of baked into Englishness?
Yeah, I mean, that comes across so powerfully, I think, in so many of the myths. I mean, many of the myths are designed to sort of hide the realities of inequality or class. You know, that's what they, that you puff them up so much in the hope that you sort of obliterate the landscape underneath you because the landscape is scarred by that kind of inequality. And I think we saw that most in our chapter in when we went to Oxford to talk about the establishment. And again, there's so many sort of myths about the establishment. But the one, you know, places like Oxford want to tell a story, which is that they represent the best of, you know, England, and there's a sort of they're an honest broker, or there's sort of, you know, they protect us from sort of ravenous populism that might take place if they didn't have these established institutions. And as always, there's some truth in that. I mean, it is really important to have really great universities doing fantastic higher education, and they create opportunity, and they have done for a very long time. But there is also the remnants of that exclusivity and inequality, which is some people don't feel welcome, and that's because they're not yet fully welcome, you know.
Yeah.
We went for a wander around Oxford and happened upon this sort of really lovely little church hall, which was having a kind of gathering of all the local charities and, you know, social enterprises and groups that do good work in Oxford. And essentially one side was all the university students and the other side was all the townspeople. And you could have been back in the 17th century. Like, they weren't talking to each other. They weren't working with each other. Tom, you know, very sort of naughtily went up to one of the student groups and said, you know, who were working on issues of domestic violence. And they said, you're interested in domestic violence in the housing estates out in East Oxford as well as on campus? And they just said, no, of course not. You know, we're the student society. That's what we do. Yeah. And look, they're not bad people. They're trying to do good things. You know, but the sort of scope of what they do is still driven by some people being in, some people being out.
Yeah.
And I think we end that chapter on the establishment by saying, look, we need these institutions. They're absolutely vital. We don't want to smash them up like Dominic Cummings wanted to do, but they've got to connect again with the whole of society, and they've got to be genuinely open. They've got to be genuinely inclusive. Otherwise, they can't do the work that we need them to.
You also, in that chapter, you know, obviously, the fact that the last four prime ministers have been Oxford graduates is indicative of something. And you make the point that the one problem is that alternate routes to power, I think you use the phrase, as a silting up. So whatever happens in that university or Cambridge and or other Russell Group universities, that there's a sort of blockage on the diversity of routes to power that, oddly enough, there used to be. And I was intrigued about what you thought about that and what the answer to that is, or is that a whole other book?
I mean, it goes back a bit to the comedians of Blackpool.
Yeah.
Where, you know, there used to be a great tradition of working class comedians coming up and getting TV shows. Now most of the comedians on TV are people who, you know, met at Oxford or Cambridge. You know, yeah. They're sort of...
With a bit of Manchester University thrown in.
Yeah. Pop music used to be working class, and middle class has saw that they're having a bit of fun, so they've taken that too. I mean, football was one of the few that haven't done that, because you can't go to university and be a Premier League footballer, it turns out. Sorry, lads. So there is a sort of sense that we're becoming more elitist, even as universities open up a bit more. There's another force going on as well, which I think is part of this dislocation with the establishment, which is the sort of globalisation of these institutions. So, you know, Oxford has had a vast investment from people who have actually not got anything to do with the university. You know, they're sort of washing their reputation quite a lot. You know, you've got the Blavatnik School of Government and the Stephen A. Schwarzman School of Humanities or whatever. You know, and there's huge investment going on, which is not really related to the people they're meant to be educating there. You know, when you're... The sources of funding now, huge donations from individuals like that, alumni donations, putting on conferences, foreign students. Only number five is educating 18 to 21-year-olds from this country. And that dislocation between the university's core purpose and where its income sources are, I think, is quite important. You're seeing it elsewhere. You're seeing it with, you know, the BBC is now trying to compete with Netflix rather than necessarily serve license fee payers.
Yeah.
And what we argue for is a sort of reconnection. And, you know, one of the best examples of that, I think, is the AstraZeneca vaccine we had during COVID, which wasn't invented in some dreaming spiral, one of these new shiny buildings paid for by some foreign billionaire. It was a really unfashionable part of Oxford up in Headington, in a building that looked like a sort of Holiday Inn, by a woman who has always struggled to get funding, and, you know, Dame Sarah Gilbert. And there's something about then how it's rolled out through Dowdy, NHS, GP surgeries and health centres, rather than some sort of world-beating app, which again felt English to me. It felt, you know, there's more in the ordinary and more talent and creativity to be had in that than in the sort of so-called symbols of brilliance and wealth and power sometimes.
We're recording this in the week of St. George's Day, and it was very interesting that Keir Starmer, subject of your biography, Tom, very good biography, went very hard on that. And I mean, it's not the first time he's sort of defined himself via patriotism, but it seemed to me reading this book that there was a lot of overlap in his approach. I mean, I think in the your biography of him, you just have friends describing him as a small town patriot, something like that, which is at odds with his media image as being, you know, the absolute archetype of the North London wokerati, lefty lawyer. You know, you fill in as applicable. But it's interesting, isn't it, that what you've described here meshes quite a bit with what seems to be his worldview.
I think it is really interesting. I mean, and perhaps it's no coincidence that, you know, there is a kind of contiguity between the two books in that they're being written at the same time. But Starmer's message for St. George's Day was significant because of the absence of some things that he could have talked about. Mm. He didn't have any of these grandiose myths. He wasn't talking about the invention of liberty or global Britain.
World-leading.
Bombast. He wasn't talking about, you know, how we've fought the war on our own. He wasn't talking about a myth of modernity either. He was talking about rather ordinary things. Service, the NHS, getting to the top of Scarfell Pike with his very disabled mother, singing Three Lions at Wembley, supporting England. And meeting people. And I think there's something in his ordinariness which has the potential, and I would stress only potential, to work quite significantly in politics. You know, if he gets the chance, and it's very difficult because politics is always meant to be being forced to do other things and be other things, but I think his instincts are to sort of fit into the folds of this country rather than impose some idea upon it.
Right.
You know, like our sort of roads bend round hillsides rather than cut through them. Or, our, you know, he's a lawyer, our common law system is based on precedent and slowly some sort of jurisprudence emerges. I think to the extent there is a sort of Starmerism, it's something that evolves with the landscape and the people rather than it's some big idea invented in Westminster or some think tank, sorry Mark, you know, which is going to solve everything. It's, and that sort of soft, gentler, people-based story could be, I think, phenomenally politically attractive over the next few years.
Just on the specifics of the flag, because he, Starmer, made a point about saying, you know, people who, I can't remember the exact phrase, people who wince at the flag or something like this. Well, I wince at the flag. I'll be absolutely honest. You know, if I'm walking through, sometimes I go and take my daughter to Rotherhithe to play football, and there's a flagpole in one of the gardens with a St. George's cross on it, and I'll be absolutely, I've got no idea who lives there. I've got no idea what it represents. But when I look at it, I kind of wince a bit, and I think, meh, it sends a bad signal. And that signal's been inculcated in me from growing up in the days when the National Front claimed that flag, you know, and it was all about this skinhead kind of racist fascist ideology that was represented by the flag. And I just wonder, is it wrong to wince at the flag still, you know?
I mean, personally, I think it's sort of definitely not wrong to wince at those associations, you know. So there was a period in time when, as you say, it was the skinheads and the National Front who grabbed hold of the flag, and it symbolised a very straightforward kind of white racism. And you know, much of my childhood was spent in the same, you know, in that era. But I think it's what we're trying to say in the book is in the same way that England as a, you know, sort of identity or as a country isn't best represented or isn't at all represented by that, neither need be the flag itself. And you've seen these moments in the last few decades where there have been sort of different variations of usages of the flag. So, you know, Tom can talk about the way in which the flag has shifted and changed in football, for example. But, you know, I always think most recently, just when we were thinking about the cover of the book, and we suggested having the flag or a version of the flag on the cover, and the few people we suggested that to were horrified because the flag has the same connotations for them as that you've described. And then I was walking through the tube like the same day as that conversation, and the playwright James Graham had a play at the National Theatre called Dear England about the England football team.
Great, brilliant team. Yeah, brilliant play.
Yeah. And the poster is a sort of 5-foot version of the flag with a little Gareth Southgate in the middle. And, you know, millions of people walking through the tube all day, every day, looking at the flag, looking at that symbol. And that's not accidental, I think, because what James is trying to do in the play, as he says, as the Gareth Southgate character says, he says, we've got to stop telling some stories and start telling new stories.
Right.
You know, so you don't stop telling stories altogether, you start selling new ones. And as you do that, you take the symbols of the old stories and you give them new meaning. And I'm hoping that's what we can do with the flag as well.
And there are probably times when people, you know, in the past when people winced or thought it was a major talking point when they saw the first black newsreader.
Right.
Or the first black player to play for England. That was, you know, Viv Anderson. Yeah. Huge news story.
Yeah.
Now we don't think anything more about it. There was a controversy when Keir Starmer started appearing on TV with a union flag in the background and lots of left-wing, but now no one mentions it anymore.
Yeah,
it's just like, and well, of course that's what
there
he does.
The storm about the bastardization of the flag on the back of the shirt.
Yeah. You know? I think we've allowed the, you know, certainly I think if you take the trouble to put a whole flag pole up in your front garden, that's probably quite strange behaviour still for me. But when more and more Labour MPs or Liberal MPs or Green MPs start actually adopting a flag like other countries do, centre-left politicians do in other countries, I think it will become normalised, and I think it's quite important. I don't think a flag's just a symbol, but part of this book is not allowing just one version of Englishness to be told. You know, there's a left-wing version of Englishness, which is also rubbish. You know, it goes about diggers and the Chartists,
Levelers,
and suffragettes. Billy Bragg. It's usually about Billy Bragg. It usually ends with Billy Bragg singing a song about the miners. There isn't just one version, and we shouldn't let the flag be associated with what just one version.
Yeah.
And I think when, you know, initially when Keir Starmer started doing, you know, clips for TV with a flag behind it, I thought it was strange. Now I think he was right.
Right.
I think we just need to normalise it on the centre-left again.
Can I ask about ordinariness again, the English ordinariness that runs through the book, like a river? Because you've both been speechwriters, comms strategists, you know, you've been intimately involved in the day-to-day battle of language. And the truth is that the day-to-day battle of language now in politics is unbelievably turbocharged. It's riven by bombast. You know, everything during COVID was world leading, even when it barely existed. Social media requires a sort of violent brevity. And none of that is desirable. But how feasible is it to bring the Zeppelin down to to earth, you know, in terms of practical politics for Starmer.
I think the truth is that it is flying in the face of a conventional wisdom. So there is a conventional political comms strategy wisdom, which is that you can't do complexity, you can't do nuance, you can't do shades of grey, you got to do
sound bites,
friend enemy vision. Find the dividing lines, yeah. Big visions, and everything
simplify and exaggerate,
exactly, and everything in three words, you know, yeah. Take back control. But I think our strong sense is that's let us down, like from all sides. So everyone who's tried to do that sort of false simplicity, big argument, you know, divide the country in half and try and bash the other lot, have left us in a horrible mess, you know. And Brexit is a perfect example of that, which is that it was just an untruth, you know, dressed up as a big exciting story, which, you know, got some people's pulses racing, but is undeliverable because the complexity of real worlds doesn't allow us to do the kind of things that Boris Johnson and others promised that we could do. So I kind of think there's a political imperative to do subtlety and nuance, because we can't solve the problems unless we do. But I'd also say that, you know, I don't think we are alone in this view. I mean, one of the things that I loved most when I was working with Ed Miliband in the old days is we flew over David Axelrod from America, and we didn't give him very much time or space to do anything. But one thing he did say all the time in the few meetings he was in, he says, "You guys want to talk sound bites and slogans all the time, just let me talk in paragraphs."
Yeah.
And I thought that's essentially the insight. We're not
David Axelrod being Obama's great advisor. Exactly. Yeah.
I think it's in nuance and ambiguity. It's not just a recognition of what the country really is. I don't think most people could place themselves exactly on some ideological spectrum. Most people have much more ambiguity. Even Nigel Farage in our book, you know, maybe he's trolling me somehow, but at the end of the interview, he said, "What's his favourite place in England?" He says, "London, because I love the diversity."
That was brilliant.
But there's something in this that as I've got older and hopefully wiser, I think I've learned that politics isn't about straight lines. It's not about cutting through that hillside. It's about trying to find a way around it. And indeed, if you can recognise nuance and ambiguity, recognise those bends in the line, then you can actually find potential to find consensus with other people. Rather than saying they are the enemy, these are our friends, we're now going to go to a political war. All this language about dividing lines in politics. We should be looking for places where we can find unity and alliance, surprising unity and alliance, because that is almost the definition of how we make progress as a country.
There's just this wonderful sentence I'd actually transcribe, because towards the end of the book. So you say, "The problem is this country is too large to hide away from the world, but also too small to change that world," which I thought was as good a kind of encapsulation of Britain's place, or England's place, I should say, in the world as I've read recently. And all right, maestros, you know, how do we negotiate that moving forward? Because you're right, we can't retreat into a sort of bucolic stroke urban ordinariness which no one cares about, but we don't have the might that many people imagine in made up slogans like Global Britain and so on. So wherein lies the nuanced, ambiguous answer? Is there an answer?
There's no one answer. There's lots of little answers. So, yeah, if you look at how, you know, if there is a Labour government, it would approach it subject of Europe. I think if they went in and said, "Right, we've got a big solution to this, we're going to go back in." Well, you're not going to do anything for 5 years then, apart from argue about Brexit again. And if you say, "Right, we're going to really make Brexit work, we're going to use our independence," well, you're going to fall flat in your face again like this government has. I think what you'll see is a sort of progressive incrementalism of step by step, you know, do you want to align? Yes. Do you want to align on a veterinary agreement, on visas, maybe
youth
on data?
Travel,
yeah. Yeah, there are areas around sort of the carbon trading area. And slowly you're going to get closer. And bit by bit, a picture emerges. Because that's what a country like Britain needs to do.
So people no longer wince.
Yeah. And not to imagine that we can reclaim some imagined greatness from the past, and that our future lies beyond Europe. It doesn't. It lies working with allies, quite difficult allies, and we're a difficult ally, and finding places where we can work together and make consensus. And we're going to need to do that over the next few years, not just on trade, but on security. You know, how Europe comes together to find a proper security pact to deal with Russia, to deal with refugees, to deal with
Trump,
climate change, and to deal with Trump. Because Europe could be fighting a war against Russia on its own in the next few years, and we haven't got a great record on that. And so, the history doesn't say you're going to succeed.
We've got to find a way. Another copy of Magna Carta again.
We're going to need to find ways of working with our closest partners, and big myths about ourselves are going to get in the way.
So what keep we need, calm and muddle through,
and find that ambiguity, find those little chinks of space where we can make a consensus with people which we wouldn't normally expect.
Tom, Mark, thank you so much
so
for coming
much.
In.
It's such an interesting
We could have
discussion.
Gone on for hours and hours.
Really, really interesting.
Waving at us wildly, so
wildly saying.
Run out of time. But the book is on sale now. It's called England, 7 Myths That Changed the Country and How to Set Them Straight by Tom Baldwin. Mark Steers, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Best with
thank
it. You. Thanks.
So, brilliant conversation. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Very, very good. We must get them back on.
Yeah, they were great.
Please, if you enjoyed the show, if you got any questions, get those into us. Any feedback to 2matts@tnepublishing.com. That's the number 2matts@tnepublishing.com. Or if you listen on Spotify, you can message us there. And that's what Cool Garrow did, who says, I'm an ex-smoker, brackets glad to be, but it's not correct to say there are no mitigating factors to smoking. Many people get a self-medicated relaxation from cigarettes. What do you think about
it? Well, I mean, the logic is unimpeachable, although it's also true of heroin.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure it's a very good way to approach life.
I don't know. So anytime you use the phrase self-medication, I think you have to question whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Yes, I mean, self-medication, I'm not sure it's generally a good thing.
No, that's right. It's like citizen journalism and nobody talking about citizen dentists.
Yeah, and Liz Truss.
It's like, no, exactly. Okay, well, anyway, thank you, Cool Garrow, for the question. And you can send in, if you're listening to this on Spotify, you can ask us any questions there, very simply indeed. We will have more questions on Sunday. Please remember our subscription offer. Head to theneweuropean.co.uk/2matts. That's the number 2MATTS, and there's a link in the show notes. And if you subscribe, you can get that free Bollocks to Brexit passport cover just in time for your summer holidays. Thanks as ever to producer Matt Hill at Rethink Audio, with support from Ollie Peart. And until next week,
it's goodbye from me.
It's goodbye from him.
Goodbye.